Hello and welcome to the Albion Roar here on Radio Reverb 97.2 FM, online at radioreverb.com, on DAB, and of course on our podcast. I'm AD Packham and we are not quite on the beach, in association with oldfootballshirts.com. Yes, we are nearly there, and bar a remarkable set of results, we'll be playing a fourth season in the Premier League next year. Or rather, September. We've been made to sweat a bit in the last week as victories for Bournemouth and Villa plus our capitulation to Man City narrowed the gap. But a hard-earned point at Southampton on Thursday has left the chasing pack requiring snookers to catch us. However, Graham Potter will want to finish the season strongly and any further points will add gloss to the season. And we can still catch Palace. Joining me today is, as ever, Alan Wares. And today we're delighted to be joined by one of the world's most respected sports writers and authors, the one and only Mr. Paul Hayward. Welcome back to the Raw, Paul. The last time you were with us was on stage at the Rialto. So it's good to see you again.
Yeah, that feels like a long time ago. Wouldn't it be nice to be in a big hall full of enthusiastic Albion fans, you know, feeling the heat and the passion and having a beer as well? That would be quite nice.
Absolutely. Actually, it's not strictly true, AD. The last time we had Paul on the show, you were actually talking to him slightly dodgily from Arsenal's press room.
This is true, in the inner sanctum of the Emirates. Yeah.
In the days when we didn't beat Arsenal.
Yes, this is very true. I mean, it's nice to actually have done the double over someone this year, and the fact it's Arsenal makes it ever so slightly sweet. But Paul, obviously football's carried on. We've been back playing for some time now. We're coming towards the end of it now. What have you made of all of this? Well, the restart as a whole, really.
Well, we've all had our Tuesday or Wednesday nights when we've been staring at the screen at 9 o'clock thinking, my God, this is a dull game and there's no atmosphere and where the hell is this all going? But overall, AD, I've enjoyed watching the games. I think it's been possible to study the games and study players and you know, get a real sense of the teams and what's going on at the various clubs without distractions. You know, it's been quite a nice kind of almost like an academic way of watching football where there's nothing to get in the way of it. But at the same time, it certainly lacked involvement and drama. I quite admire the players for coming back in the way that they have. I think the attitude of most sets of players, one or two exceptions, has been exceptional. They've really got on with the job. They've applied themselves. And overall, I'd say thank God it's back, because imagine the last 6 weeks with no football, because there's been not a lot of anything else. So football's saved us in many respects.
Well, the point is that, I mean, I think the Premier League have pretty much said, and I was a member of the Football Sports Association meeting, the Zoom meeting we had last month, and they actually, you know, acknowledged, they said that we've got restart going because it's going to cost us too much not to. And they sort of highlighted various scenarios, the worst one of which is to completely abandon the season as it was, you know, with whatever it was, 9 games to go at the time. And completely, you know, and everything stopped. And this is where then the lawyers kick in and take over. So they've kind of had to do it. But I think also in so doing, they've now created another rod for their own back, in as much as they want the next season to start as early as possible. And they're mooting out September the 12th. And yet the science hasn't changed as to how this is going to go forward, especially, I'll put this to you, inviting fans back in.
Yeah, you're right, Alan. I mean, the reason they were so desperate to get back on was to not to have to hand back the TV money. And there's a huge financial imperative. I think they've made it work in terms of the, you know, secure environments. But they will see next season as a continuation of this, in the sense that it's the same deal. You know, they don't want to give the TV money back. They that's their lifeblood, they'll just carry on in empty stadiums if they have to on the same routine. I mean, there's some news today from the government about possible reintegration of fans, you know, over in a staged way starting in October, some experiments in August at Goodwood Racecourse, for example, and then, you know, by the middle of the autumn, it's possible that we'll see decent numbers of fans in stadiums. But it does feel a long way off still, doesn't it?
It does for me. I can't see where the science hasn't changed yet. I mean, with the COVID virus, is it now so exhausted it can't make that 2 meter leap that it's, you know, it can only make 1 meter leap. And you know, I mean, this is something I've wanted to talk about on this show, and if you're okay, I want to mention this now. Is that, like I say, it can't be 100% straight away. Or if it is, then 100% is going to be quite a way into the distance. We're nowhere near this yet. So my point would be is if they want to do it 25%, 30%, 40%, and what have you, how on earth do they actually choose who those 25% are? I don't know if you've spent time thinking about this, either of you, but how on earth is this going to work?
Well, it's going to be done on a ballot basis. I mean, that's that's been done, come out today anyway. But I mean, for instance, the point I was about to make was that Brian Owen did a good piece in the Argus yesterday, where he spoke to the people at Le Havre. They had a friendly this week against PSG at home in their, I don't know what the capacity was.
Of course, the French league has stopped, hasn't it? Yes.
And but they had a friendly against PSG this week with supporters in the stadium, but only 5,000. Everyone was wearing masks. Everyone, unless you're a member, members of your own family can sit together, or I guess your bubble can sit together. Otherwise, you have to be spaced. But it's very difficult because you've got people behind and people in front, and it's very difficult to police. So I mean, one assumes, AD, that
they've done this with a robust track and trace system, one that we don't have in this country. Did Brian mention that at all?
Well, I mean, the piece is in the Argus, so it's there for everyone to see. Yeah. I mean, it was. The term track and trace was not mentioned because it was an article about football, Al.
Yeah, I know, but we're also talking about, you know, the sort of the spread of a deadly virus. Paul, have you actually spent much time thinking about how this could work?
Yeah, I have, because I've been into football stadiums, and I've been onto race courses that have been completely empty. And obviously, your natural inclination is to think, well, how could this work technically? Because it is a technical challenge. I respect what you're saying, Alan, but at the same time, pubs and shops and restaurants and all sorts of areas of society, public transport, have faced the same issues. And ultimately, it should be possible to get people into stadiums in a safe way. It's not going to be easy, but if you can get six people in a pub around a table having a meal now, as you can, there must be some way of spacing people out at stadiums to maybe one third, half fill them. It's not ideal, and you're right to say that people will feel very aggrieved when they see that the guy next door got in, but they didn't. And how do you choose? The ballot system is the one that other sports are talking about. So again, it's an imperfect world, and I think if we could get a few in, then it would be better than another season with nobody in.
Yeah, I mean, the figure that's being bandied about is 40% full. But I don't see how they can possibly do it. But I mean, it is weird. I mean, obviously, I've met you at a couple of the games at the Amex, and it's just been a very surreal, soulless bowl, for want of a better phrase.
I mean, I think there's a big issue with indoors and outdoors, because it's safer outdoors than indoors. So what you couldn't have is large numbers of people congregating at the bars at half time and before and after the game, for example. You might well have to just not have any catering and not have any bars open. And it's just a question of filing in safely, sitting in your seat and leaving after the game. Again, a lot of people would find that pretty unsatisfying. Okay. It would be interesting to hear from fans whether they'd rather do that, go to a game in a sanitized way, or carry on watching it on the box and saving their money.
Well, there was a few people on North South Chat today, actually, who were saying they would rather stay at home if it's going to be a sanitised. You can't sing, you can't have a drink, or you can't have a pie or whatever.
I mean,
one thing that I've noticed, I think I said this on the show last week, is the fact that football, for me, it's a very social thing. It's about
for most of us.
It's not necessarily about the 90 minutes on the pitch, although obviously that's the reason we're going. We're going to talk about the games and analyse the games a little bit later on. But, it's about more than that. It's about being the social element of it and seeing friends and colleagues and just being a part of something bigger, I guess, being part of a family and as we know, the Albion is very much ingrained in its community.
Did you use the word family, AD?
Huh?
Did you use the word family? You're not Sepp Blatter, you know. You might look like him.
But... No, I'm breathing in. Okay, I mean, we're going to talk about some football in a minute, but I mean, Paul, I mean, Brighton were front and centre throughout the lockdown. What was the general consensus amongst the press back of the role that Paul Barber and the club played as the negotiators were going on to get it started?
Well, actually, the entire football writing fraternity felt that Brighton was really leading the way. And I can tell you that they were incredibly grateful to them as well for holding long press conferences once a week, because there was a time when Brighton were the only club doing that. And it was incredibly beneficial for football journalism to be able to speak to Graham Potter and Paul Barber and people every single week. And they talked intelligently and interestingly about all the big issues. It felt for a while as if Brighton were sort of leading the resistance to football returning, if you like, whether that's correct or not. When the point came where it looked like it was going to be safe again and that it could happen, Brighton were immediately enthusiastic about it. And I thought the way their attitude, everything perked up at the club, and they seemed to say, right, let's get back out there and stay in the Premier League. The transition from doubt to positivity, I thought, was really impressive.
Mm. Yeah, because there were some brickbats thrown at us by various members of, I guess, other teams and other team supporters, that the whole reason that we were talking in a negative sense about it returning was because we didn't want to get relegated. But that was never on the table.
But can I just say there, AD, I mean, the whole brouhaha did kick off about the Albion leading the way and not wanting to play on neutral venues. And that's a little bit of a sort of a misstep there, I think, because talking to the guys at the Premier League, and I'm sure that Paul does on a sort of semi-regular basis as well, is that it was just an idea that was being floated about. It's not something that they were going to put to other clubs and what have you. And so somewhere down the line, someone from a Premier League club, and they have their suspicions, but someone from a Premier League club went and blabbed to someone else and saying, we're possibly going to do this. And by the next thing you know is the Albion's name is on a list of potential neutral venues, and this is before the Albion have known anything about it. So the name is the list has come out of half a dozen possible neutral venues. They've come out and said, hang on, we don't know anything about this, and that's then get reported as the Albion are dead set against it. The fact that they were is not the point. So then you have to be a little bit careful as to what is actually sort of like the story going on here. I mean, Glenn Murray, you're quite right, did express reservations, but I think it's the reservations that the vast majority of professional athletes, who incidentally are actually putting themselves out on the line, you know, at the forefront of professional athletes who are out there. And he quite rightly expressed reservations. Now, the fact is he's now gone out there and with the rest of them, with all the safeguards that they put in place, as Paul said, you know, they've really gone and thrown themselves into it. So, yeah,
every doubt they did express was perfectly reasonable. And they were leading the way on responding in the community, trying to help in the community with health services and testing and so on. And they were, everybody agrees that Brighton were not the only club that behaved in that way, but they were the sort of model club, really, and a huge amount of goodwill attached itself to them as a result. And of course, and the best thing about it from the fans' point of view is that they won all those plaudits for being so civilized and sensible and constructive and socially concerned. And then when the game started again, they came out with, they came out of the traps brilliantly and beat Arsenal and took a point at Leicester. And then you looked at the team and thought, wow, their mindset is absolutely right. So that was pleasing.
Mm. Okay, well, just before we move on, Paul, obviously we were very vocal in getting the games played at home venues. Now we're coming to the end of this period of games. Do you think having the games at places like that, at the home grounds, has had an impact?
I looked at this at the start when the Bundesliga came back and the home teams appeared to be at a disadvantage. Do you remember those days when we were all talking about that? The home advantage seemed to go out the window because away teams were coming into away grounds and not feeling the same intensity and hostility, and results were levelling themselves out. I haven't studied the figures since then, but all I could say is that there's been an interesting distinction between clubs, teams who've come back sort of ready to fight, and teams who've sort of slightly, you know, fallen out of the dressing room and look a bit half-hearted.
Well, we haven't lost away from home yet, so it can't be that bad.
Okay. Well, let's talk about some football then, but not too much because we don't want to ruin
it
too
show, much. Mate, don't worry.
Yeah, I know. But obviously, there was
okay, technical.
To talk about. We're going to talk about the Southampton game in a minute, but we've just got to at least pay lip service to the complete and utter capitulation against Man City.
Mate, they were that good. I know they were that good.
What I want to talk about here is not how bad we were, but how good Man City were, and the fact that the way that they played, they just to maintain that level of pressing and the hunger to get the second ball and to the turnovers all over the pitch, it must be exhausting. I mean, that's the way that Pep wants them to play. I mean, do you think that had anything to do with the fact that they haven't been so competitive this year?
I think it's got a lot to do with the fact that they're still in the Champions League and they desperately want to win the Champions League. And they, even though the Premier League title went for them a long time ago, they are focused on August still. Guardiola doesn't need to win the Champions League, but you can see why Man City have got this long-term target. And of course, with that in mind, they haven't been able to switch off. They haven't wanted to switch off. So they've come to a place like Brighton and think, right, let's pass them to death. Let's keep our form up. Let's keep our level up because we're going to need it in August when we get back in the Champions League.
Yeah, I mean, all the goals that we conceded were pretty much all individual errors, really. But that's the way they force you into making those, and they set the traps all over the pitch for you to do so.
Yeah, they're ball hounders, they're ball retrievers. When they lose possession, the whole religion of Guardiola at Barcelona, that's what he changed at Barcelona, was that when Barcelona lost possession, they hounded it back, and he's taken that principle to Manchester City. And Brighton only need to be 10% or 5% off it in a game like that for them to get punished very quickly by a team who can just cut through you before you've even, put your boots on, really.
I mean, there was an element of that. There's too many of our players out that had 5 out of 10 performances rather than...
But they can make you look like a 5 out of 10. I mean, the point being is that, like I say, I mean, when Man City are on that kind of form, there isn't a... You know, there's obviously, we know there's divisions within divisions in the Premier League, and Liverpool and Man City are so far ahead of us. All right, now and again, we can give Liverpool a game. We can't give Manchester City a game. It's just the conflicting styles. I mean, you always get a punch of chance, don't you? With Liverpool, there's always something there. I mean, the results never look good, but we always play quite well against them. With Man City, we get stuffed every time. And
we didn't in the FA Cup semi-final. I mean, look what they did to Watford in the final. Obviously, that was under a different manager and a different regime, a different style of playing. I guess Graham Potter would have gone to Wembley with the mindset to actually be more open, I guess. The same thing would have happened to Watford.
Don't forget, Graham Potter did play against Man City last season and should have beaten them, but for a couple of moody VAR referee decisions. They scored a goal against his side scored a goal against Man City, which is the very epitome of what he's trying to achieve here.
Well, I went into this game expecting exactly that to happen, but
Sorry, what you were going to say?
It's quite funny that we'll be all sitting around talking about Brighton surviving and what a great restart they've had. They lost 11-1 to Man City, Liverpool, and Man United at home. They got really pasted 3 times in a row at home by top 4 clubs, and yet it feels no big deal because. They got picked up 8 points, got to 37 points, almost certainly safe. And those really heavy home defeats sort of don't feel that relevant, although they were quite slightly worrying at the time. I mean, what they did was run into, the champions, Liverpool, and two teams, Man United and Man City, were very hungry and very sharp on the night. And as we know, individual errors by Brighton players put the team on the back foot very quickly against superior opposition. You can get hammered like that, but we'll talk about the Southampton game later. But the Southampton game didn't half stabilize everything and put you back in touch with the good performances before those three home games.
We're going to talk about your book that you're in the process of writing a little bit later on. But one person who might feature in that is the man who scored a hat trick in that game at the Amex last week, and that was Raheem Sterling. Now, I mean, the guy's come on leaps and bounds from, I mean, obviously the transfer to Man City and playing under Pep. But as an England player going forwards, I mean, is he our most important player, or has other players surpassed him, or are you excited about this new England team?
Oh God, I really am. I mean, I don't think, I've been doing this job for 33 years, and I don't think I've seen a better crop of young players. And I mean, we could talk a lot about the golden generation when there were some really, you know, serious midfield players involved in that group as well. But as a forward line, I mean, put it this way: 12 months from now, Gareth Southgate might be able to look at Marcus Rashford, Raheem Sterling, Mason Greenwood, Jadon Sancho, Harry Kane, and think, I've got to pick three of those, you know. I've got to leave two of those out. And I think Rashford is magnificent, and or could be magnificent, but I think the one that, to me, that's going to be the next great England attacking player is Mason Greenwood. I think he is exceptional. I think they've really found one there.
Yeah, I mean, you got to see him at close quarters when United came to the Amex. I mean, that goal, I mean, he had such quick feet. There was no defending it.
No, he's so sharp and focused in his movements. He concentrates. He's very composed. He's got two good feet. He hits the ball, you know, thunderously. He's a lethal finisher. But he's got that coolness. He's got that brain where his positional sense is good. And as you said, he's got the quick feet and the intent to carry it off. And all he's got to do is stay on this path. And I think he will be, you know, potentially one of the great Man United players and potentially a great England player as well.
And we're talking about players going forward there and, the youngsters that have got there. But we've got someone, I suppose we still consider him a youngster, but, you know, a defender, Lewis Dunk, he's had one game. And again, is there a kind of a rattling within the press pack, within the press corps, or even amongst other quarters that Lewis Dunk should or could be a bit more in Gareth Southgate's thoughts?
Well, has he missed his chance?
Well, it's a tricky one, this, you know, because Lewis Dunk is on the, you'd say he's on the fringe of the England squad, okay? Mm-hmm. And but I do think, I don't know whether you want to get into this, but I think it's fair enough that he has a decision to make this summer, because he's had three seasons in the Premier League where he's more or less been involved in not a relegation battle all the way through, but at various points in those three seasons, and for long periods quite often, he's been fighting against relegation. He's been threatened with relegation. And I remember Howard Wilkinson telling me about a player that he had who was in a relegation battle week after week after week, and it destroyed him. I'm not saying that Lewis Dunk is on the verge of being destroyed, but if he wants to get out of the relegation zone, I could see why he might be thinking about what he should do next.
So do you think this sort of short break that we've got before next season is kind of really going to define the rest of Lewis Dunk's career?
Yeah, because the team is, the club's going in the right direction, as it has been for ages. The team's going in the right direction, you feel. But he's got to ask himself whether he wants to stick around and take the chance that it doesn't continue to progress, and that, you know, he's on 37 points again this time next year, or whether he wants to take the chance to play for a team higher up the league and see what he can get from his talent.
I mean, this is a question we ask at the end of every season from the Championship.
It's an old chestnut, yeah, for sure.
There's only one person who can ever really answer that question, and that's Lewis himself, I guess.
I can see Lewis doing a Letitia and forsaking a potential England career for the sake of, you know, hometown stuff. Even though he's a Chelsea fan, I can see him sticking around.
Okay, well, before we move on, I mean, whilst we're talking about Man City, you mentioned it briefly there, Paul. Obviously, way back in the annals of time when this was first muted, that Paul Barber was very much again front and centre of the FFP debate, and we were banging the drums about that and supporting it and the reasons for that. Where do we go with this? Where do we go with FFP from here? Because obviously,
we need Kieran Maguire for this, mate.
we need Kieran Maguire in this one, but yeah, I don't know. Well, I mean,
hang on, AD, you're struggling here, mate. Paul, I mean, this is a UEFA thing, and it's done on national level, but this is very much a UEFA thing, and they seem to have capitulated. What on earth is going on?
Well, what is going on is that they made a mess of the case against Manchester City. It wasn't watertight. Everybody felt before it went to CAS, Court of Arbitration for Sport, that the scale of the Man City legal team was going to be a major problem for UEFA, and that if there was any hole in their argument, that the Man City lawyers would drive a lorry straight through it, and that's exactly what they did. And they effectively destroyed what looked like at the beginning a pretty strong case against Man City for evading the regulations. They even managed to it was such a victory for them, they even managed to get off the charge of misleading UEFA, because they argued that they didn't trust the process and they didn't feel they could cooperate with it because it was loaded against them. And you see, in that situation, you see how clever legal language is. When you get powerful people, powerful lawyers involved, they can get you out of most scrapes.
Mm. But, I mean, where do we go going forwards with FFP? Because, I mean, obviously it affects all the clubs, particularly in this climate where we're coming out of this pandemic, where a lot of clubs, particularly lower down the pyramid, are struggling financially. We're going to talk about the window and
FFP is slightly different lower down the leagues than it is in the Premier League. It's a different.
But at the end of the day, the rules, the basis of it is you can't spend more than that you actually earn. City have got away with
Paul this. Paul says you consider the legalese for this. It's just absolutely ridiculous. And you know, it's an average of over 3 years, and then throw the numbers up in the air. You know, we've been used to being in the Championship and League One and League Two, and it's much more straightforward. This time around, it's you can get away with murder, murder. So,
but does this mean that Mr. Chairman can now put his fingers in his hands in his pocket and just spend whatever he wants?
Yep.
I think we're in what's going to happen is there'll be a huge audit in Premier League clubs in the autumn. Everybody will look at how much they've lost. Owners will ask themselves how committed they are. Everybody will look at the transfer market and say, has it been affected? You know, have prices collapsed or dropped, and everybody will measure where they want to go from there and how much they want to spend. And you know, Tony Bloom will make those calculations as well. He'll have taken a hit. He'll look at the market, because there's nobody better at looking at markets than Tony Bloom, and he'll say to himself, you know, what's my budget going to be next season? Spent a lot of money last year, didn't he? On a lot of players who mostly were successes. But the league position now tells you that he's probably going to have to do that again if the Graham Potter revolution is to continue. All these really difficult decisions for all those clubs to make, irrespective of what Manchester City do and whether they go in and spend another $300 million, you know.
You are listening to the Albion Roar here on Radio Reverb, 97.2 FM, online at radioreverb.com on DAB. And of course, on our podcast, this show, as ever, is brought to you in association with the brilliant oldfootballshirts.com, which is the home to over, I think it's 110,000 football shirts.
I know, he's so selfish, isn't he, Phil?
It's amazing, absolutely amazing. So, I mean, go knock yourselves out, go over there, have a browse through and find the mingers. That's what I like to do. Find the mingers.
Really?
Find the worst shirts you can possibly find. Usually, they're usually associated with Hearts of Bristol. There's a clue. We've got a shirt that Phil sent us over here, Paul. If you could just have a look at that and describe that for me and see if you can work out where it's from and who it is.
Well, it's a black and white striped number with a neat sort of black round collar and a button. I like the button. That adds a kind of high street sports casual look to the shirt. The sponsor is Eurobel. I haven't heard of them. The crest looks like a sort of university badge. I can't work out who they are. But it's a very smart shirt. And of course, you think straight away of Inter Milan as soon as you see it.
Yeah. I mean, it's made by Player, which is, again, another... I mean, Phil loves his shirt manufacturers. I think he's, you know, Nike is devil spawn for him. So I've never heard of Player, which is P-L-A-A-Y-A, which is, think a sort of a bastardization of the word beach. But as for the badge, I'm going to take a punt here, AD, because I think I recognise the badge, although I don't recognise the shirt. Is it Stockport County?
No, but you are in the right country, so that's a good start.
Well, that's a fun one.
You're not in the right county, although actually you are in the right county right now, because this is your shirt of the week and chosen for no particular reason, although it's quite a decent design. This is the 1998-99 away shirt of our Football League neighbours, Crawley Town. They play at the 6,134 capacity Broadfield Stadium, currently known as the People's Pension Stadium, which they moved to in 1997. The season this shirt was worn, the club were playing in the Southern League Premier Division and finished second, and only the winners of the league got promoted. The club was formed in 1896 and played as an amateur team until 1962 when they went semi-pro and ultimately became a professional football side in 2005 and achieved promotion to the Football League in 2011, nicknamed the Red Devils. They had their fair share of financial run-ins, and I know a few about those, but that's another story for another day. And they went into administration in 1999, were bought by a local business, and who, through shrewd investment, got them promoted to the National League, conference in 2004, and the club was sold and bought a few times. Financial problems followed, but they now seem to be on an even keel with stable ownership and are reasonably established in the Football League. Despite being our closest neighbours, Brighton and Crawley have only ever played one competitive match against each other. I remember this one. It was a third round of the FA Cup tie in January 1992. Can you remember the score, anyone?
Yep, 5-0.
It was 5-0 to the Albion.
Chapman scored a hat-trick.
And he was in front of a crowd reported to be 18,000. Plenty of recent Albion associations. Michel Kuipers, Matt Sparrow, Gary Dicker, Tom Dallinson, Paul Armstrong, Romain Vanceleu, even Johnny Dixon, to name a few. There are understandably loads more. When I looked into it, though, that I found there are some more historic tie-ups. Raphael Meade finished his career in Crawley with 55 appearances between 95 and 96. And he was briefly joined by Colin Pates during that time. Pete O'Sullivan.
It's a real graveyard place, isn't it?
Richard Tiltman made 50-odd appearances. And for those a little bit more senior, Nobby Upton, he spent 6 years in the Albion, moved to Crawley in 1966 before emigrating to South Africa. There we go. Thanks for that, Bill. So that's
oldfootballshirts.com. It's a real junkyard, isn't it, of Brighton players, isn't it? Right, if you finish your career, right, go to Crawley. They might give you a game.
You know what, though? Looking at that, that's a decent five-a-side team there, right? I mean, Kuipers, Sparrow,
Yeah, much maiming going on. The reason we didn't get that badge is because it's obviously changed since then.
Yeah.
And to be honest, I actually prefer that badge. It's back in the day of where nowadays, and I've said this before, nowadays where most badges are done by as a kind of a single layer graphic design. In those days, and that's what this looks like, is it's the Crawley Borough badge. So, and that's what a lot of clubs used. So.
Well, Phil mentioned a player from the 60s there, but unfortunately we have sad news to relate, which is that his alumni recently passed away, although I have no idea whether he played with Nobby Upton or not, but Alex Dawson now.
Yeah, he was is a name that sort of conjures from the past. He was actually, I believe, one of the Busby Babes. Somehow managed to find his way here. Played for the Albion from 68 to 71, which I assume would be at the towards the end of his career. Maybe he went to Crawley afterwards just to see if, you know, he could jumpyard it even further. But I was just asking people what they remember of him. And the main thing seems to be was kind of he picked up where Bobby Smith, left off. A real sort of bruising, crunching sort of fella who'd go in for a challenge, you know, it would be ball... Dawson, goalkeeper, the lot in the net, goal given. That was in the days when, you know, two-footed hacks and mains were just rewarded with a ticking off. So, you know, your classic big number nine, even though I'm led to believe he wasn't all that big. But certainly when he scores 29 goals in 65 appearances, that's not a record to be sniffed at. I know that he's being mourned across the football world, especially at Manchester United. For people of a certain vintage, looking at Paul, wondering if he saw him play. It's a sad day at the Albion.
How dare you?
It's not my, Paul's not actually that much older than us, unfortunately. Moving swiftly on. Let's move on to this week's game, which a trip away to Southampton. Normally, just a short hop across the along the coast for us to this one.
But, yeah, a nightmare to get to on the train normally. When it's I mean, as away days go, it's a pig. I mean, don't get me wrong, it's fine when it's closed down, but getting to London is easy. Getting to Southampton is a nightmare.
2.5 hours for that journey.
Yeah, any journey that takes as long on a train as it does on the road is a bad rail journey, isn't it? Let's face it. It should be quicker on the train.
Who wants to stop at Barnum? There's nothing there.
No, I mean, those stops. Nobody gets on, nobody gets off at least half of those stops.
It's the people who get on and off at Ford that I'm more interested in. But anyway. Okay, so funnily enough, all change again for the Albion on this one, with a rare start for Glenn, with him partnering the returning Morfo in what looked to be a 4-4-2 formation. Lamptey and Solly March also returned. We were talking on our WhatsApp group before the game, and I kind of hinted that Glenn might get a run out here. And you know what? He was great.
I'm glad he did. And not just because he said nice things about me on the big screen at the Manchester United game at half time. I'm now
You did not retire.
When I didn't retire. I'm permanently indebted now to Glenn Murray. And I mean, I liked him anyway. I mean, Brighton wouldn't be where they are now without Glenn Murray, let's face it. And it was so nice to see him get a start, and also to flick that header on for the goal, you know, to play a part, give an assist. And he deserves it. He was brilliant during the lockdown. He was so articulate and dignified in talking for the club. Had a difficult time, hasn't been able to get in the team or even on the pitch mostly in this restart period. But started against Southampton, the formation worked. It was a good point, and it was really nice to see him get involved in the goal.
Yeah, it's funny. You mentioned his lack of starts since the restart. I mean, he was he was starting every game prior to lockdown, wasn't he? So, I mean, almost as if that Potter had run out of any ideas, but I mean, Glenn was getting more and more game time, and he was integral to a lot of the good results that we had, particularly away from home. And this is what our sixth game away from home without defeat. Is it six or seven?
But AD, for all the sexy football that Graham Potter's actually put across to us, that's the part where Glenn really doesn't fit in. I mean, it's not to say he's not part of Potter's plans. He clearly is. But certainly for a lot of that first half, and for the first part of the second half, you know, there was a lot of long ball stuff. There was stuff that was going up to Glenn. Some of it was sticking. Some of it he was trying to buy a foul and so on and so forth. But, you know, when Southampton did equalise, and I'm not sure if Glenn does have 90 minutes in him anymore. We'll soon find out, I'm sure, one day. But, you know, we changed the style. We changed the personnel. We changed the style. And the long balls were a lot less because, you know, the players that we brought on weren't players that could hold it up just as well. And certainly when Southampton improved in the second half, and there's no way they were going to be as bad as they were in the first half, you know, it's a tactic that it actually was made to look Houghton-esque. In other words, it was just one thing: get it straight up there, see if it sticks. And for me, it didn't work. And that's if that's Glenn's contribution to Graham Potter's management, then it's going to be limited.
Paul?
Well, I think this period has shown how many variations there are on Graham Potter's approach to setting the team up, because we've seen every one of them, I think. You know, for example, the Manchester United game where he played with Connolly and McAllister behind him, that was very experimental. He's used every formation, really. You know, the 4-4-1-1, he's tried two up together last night, all sorts of variation, which suggests many things. He's managed to get all the players involved, which I think has been good. It means that he's not wedded to one idea, although he does have certain sort of non-negotiable principles, like, you know, passing out from the back and keeping possession and so on. But you know, the upshot is that through all that variation, and you could argue experimentation, he's managed to pick up 8 points and get them to the point where they look unassailable. It's pretty good work, really. I could have, a lot of managers in that situation, but I kept it very simple, played the same way every week, not taking any chances, you know, relied on the same players. But he's really mixed it up and been rewarded for it.
Yeah, there has been an awful lot of rotation. And I mean, he's made a career out, I guess, out of picking horses for courses in that. I mean, there's also a lot to be said for having a settled team in certain games. And I think obviously the Man City game is, again, a very experimental lineup, but it's the back four is largely staying the same. But we've seen Tariq Lamptey, who's a player that's impressed all of us, coming in now. What have you made of Lamptey?
Oh, I think it's one of those, transformational signings, really. I don't think Chelsea wanted to sell him. It wasn't that he was discarded. It was just that, you know, he felt he needed to leave. He got Reece James in front of him in the right back position, and he was probably thinking that he wasn't going to play very much. And, Brighton were quick enough and smart enough to get in there and pick up a player who's dynamic, energetic, he attacks well, he defends well. He's one of those people you look at and you just think, wow, that was a bit of a coup. I remember feeling, I remember watching Bruno play, might have been his first game for Brighton, played at Lewis actually, and I thought, I thought, God, the right back position has just gone up a level at Brighton. You know, they've got one there. And Tariq Lamptey is a very different player, but it's a comparable kind of victory in the transfer market, really.
Absolutely.
Yeah, but getting Lamptey from Chelsea in that manner, though. I mean, it's players are possibly looking at this now. I mean, that they've seen the move that Jadon Sancho made when he went to Dortmund because he didn't think he was going to get any game time at City, and we're seeing this blueprint now for the players that if they want to get game time, they're looking at leaving the big clubs rather than just staying around and picking up their wage packets.
Well, City and Chelsea have basically hogged the sort of like the kids anyway, haven't they? I mean, Southampton produced quite a few good ones over the years, but you know,
yeah, another good one started last night. Actually.
Yeah, but they basically hogged it all, and I think that way, sort of, so many careers can easily crash and burn and end up in ruins. And I think that Lamptey, even at the age of 19, is clever enough to know that if he wants to actually kickstart his career, then you know, if he's good enough to be picked for Chelsea's first team in a game like against Arsenal, then he's clearly sort of the good enough for the Premier League. And that said, you know, here we are talking about him. What's he played now? 6 times for us. Six. I would say that was his sixth best game for us. If I'm being
it was still involved in the goal, though.
If I'm being charitable, yeah, it was his throw-in. But I think sort of, you know, with his first duty, which is to be a defender. You know, he as a raiding fullback, you know, he can really hit the afterburners. But I thought he was actually a little bit sort of too left-footed last night. Okay. Didn't have his best game, I felt.
Okay. Well, moving on for that, we've got I mean, we did take the lead in this game, and we mentioned that it was Lamptey that took the throw, and it was a great run to get to the position where to flick the ball on from Glenn, actually. But it was finished with aplomb by Neil Morquay. That was his 10th goal of the season, 10 goals in his first season. I mean, can we have some love for Morquay?
Can we what, sorry?
Have some love for Morquay?
Yeah, you'll do.
Go on.
I can't help feeling that, but for more composure in front of goal, he could have easily doubled that total. You think of how many he's missed, which, frankly, he could have tucked away. Yes, he is. There's something about him. Yes, he's a menace. He will probably be on the Arsenal defence's Christmas card list. Never, but. There is something about him, and there is more to come. But at the moment, I can't help feeling that he really should be a little bit more composed in front of goal.
Paul?
Yeah, I think a really important point about the recruitment last year was that most of the players they bought are completing their first season in the Premier League. That first season is difficult for anybody. Webster's an obvious example. He's had an up and down season. Mopay is learning the very difficult craft of being a Premier League centre forward, because do you remember when he started, he was out wide and then he came in through the centre, and he's played largely number nine, I think, for Graham Potter. And I agree with Alan. I think the one doubt about him is his conversion rate isn't as high as it could be, because his composure isn't always there. But I do think he'll improve on that front. And that goal he scored against Southampton was very composed. Yes. That looked like was a proper top Premier League finish. And if he can keep doing that next season, I think he's going to be good.
Yeah. He took his goal against Arsenal.
Yeah. I mean, he's been in that position many times, and like you say, his conversion rate isn't great. But I mean, Morpay's now become the sixth French player to score 10 plus goals in their debut Premier League season, and he's among the company.
Where did you get that from?
It was, wonderful stat. Let me get a pen.
92-93, Eric Cantona.
Oh no,
Thierry Henry, Olivier Giroud, Anthony Martial, Lacazette, and now Neil Morpay. So
I also reckon he must already be in the top 10 of Albion scorers in the top division all the time. And I mean, because there can't be that many scorers.
Well, Glenn's up there. I mean, he got Glenn's 13 last year, 12 the year before.
The top one's Michael Robinson, and that's it.
Okay. I should say I like his attitude a lot. He's a serious. He really wants it. He's a committed player, and I think he's got a really good work ethic. And the way he stood up to Guendouzi in that Arsenal game, I thought was fabulous. He could have got pushed around in that game, because it wasn't just Guendouzi giving him grief. The other Arsenal players joined in, and Mopay didn't care. He took it and gave it back. And I thought that was a good sign.
Totally. He got the last word twice.
Two last words.
Now, Paul, Paul, I know we're biased here, but and we haven't had a chance to talk to someone like yourself about it, but you know, Guendouzi's throttle on Mopay, which should have been seen, there should have been some sort of sanction with that. I mean, is there a rule for one against the others?
Well, the worst thing about it was that it fed straight into Jose Mourinho's persecution complex as well, because he used it subsequently in relation to Eric Dier, you know, who was punished for marching up into the stands to confront absolutely, totally unrelated issues, different transgressions, but Mourinho managed to make them, the same thing. But going back to your point, Guendouzi should have been punished for that, because in one of the pictures, he's actually squeezing his throat. You know, that's just dangerous, reckless conduct. And how he got away with that, I'll never know.
Sure. And the intent was written all over his face as well. So, I mean, I baffled. I mean, he has subsequently been sanctioned by Arsenal, and he hasn't played since, I don't think. So,
That tells you everything. And they know that they've got a problem with him, and they know that he's got a major problem. It wasn't just that incident. He was bombed after that, and the club were looking at him thinking, is he worth it? Which is a shame, because he's a good player.
Okay. Well, the equaliser did come, and it was very much a game of two halves as well. I mean, Southampton massively improved in the second half, and they were very, very impressive, as they have been since the restart, actually. How impressed have you been by Southampton, actually? I mean, it's testament to sticking by the manager, really, isn't it?
Yeah, for a team who lost 9-0 at home to Leicester, they are remarkable, I must say. And it was a remarkable show of faith to give the manager a new four-year contract in the middle of the lockdown, you know, given that they had that 9-0 defeat still really haunting them, I suppose. And they've done ever so well. They've got some good players. He went back to basics, stopped trying to be kind of too adventurous and elaborate, and the players have repaid him by going up a level. And I think they're looking like, well, at the very least, a top 10 side, aren't they?
That's the thing about a 9-0 defeat, something like that, is that in the Premier League, for the most part, they are a freak result. It's usually the combination of the players on one side having a bad day, the players on the other side having a really, really good day. If it was happening week in, week out, then you've got a major problem. But a freak result like that, a 9-0 defeat, weirdly enough, you can't actually learn a great deal about your players from a 9-0 defeat. It's only in the subsequent games you can really learn about them. And they kind of responded accordingly. I don't suppose Hasselhoff or whatever his name is has particularly done any great things.
His name translates to rabbit hutch.
Okay.
Is passing people.
Yeah, but that's actually done anything great apart from, as Paul said, go back to basics and actually say, right, this is what we should be doing. I say you can't really learn much about your players from a 9-0 defeat.
But yeah, but I mean, come back from that, they did, and come back in this game, they did. And it was as simple as our goal was. This was a simple one for them as well. It's the ball over the top from the impressive Redmond, who's got to be an England reckoning again, I would say. And Danny Ings, who is on fire.
Ings was a total menace. I mean, Nathan Redmond is a funny one because he was actually out of favour for quite a while at Southampton. And yet, every single time I've seen him play, he's actually just pulled strings in the way that Aaron Moy did when he first joined us. You know, he'd be, you know, in the middle of the park, spraying passes around, making sure everyone does that. Moy, for me, has gone off the boil a little bit. But Redmond, every time I've seen him, I'm thinking, you know, you're I'm not saying you're keeping Southampton up on your own, but he's been so impressive.
Talking of going on and off the boil, I'm really pleased to see Trossard playing well again, because I started to worry about him in mid-season. I thought he completely lost his way, became innocuous basically, and he's been really good in the last 2 or 3 weeks, and that's a relief because he has the talent, and he was one of the best of the summer buys in terms of his natural ability.
Absolutely.
Did you know much about him before he joined the Albion?
No, I didn't, but I know that he's got a proper pedigree. And when he joined, I thought he was very influential very quickly. He's a positive player. You know, he was always looking to make things happen. And then in mid-season, I can't pretend to know why, he just seemed to just go off the boil. And he didn't actually start the restart that brilliantly, but in the last 2 or 3 weeks, he's really found his way again, hasn't he?
I mean, there was a game against Man United. I mean, admittedly, it was very much a case of after the Lord Mayor's show, but he seemed to be playing a lot more centrally in that game, and he was pivotal to all the good stuff that we're actually doing. And I think it's just a confidence thing. We see this time and time again with players, but you know, that gave him the confidence to go forward. And then he went on a goal scoring run after that. And nearly scored again last night with a header from the edge of the area, which you wouldn't expect from someone like him.
No, he's a dangerous player. He's a dangerous player.
Absolutely. I just worry about how much he looks like Lee Hendry, and I hope he doesn't go down that road.
He's more Robbie Williams to me, but you know. It's,
But actually, AD, I know you're going to come to him because I want to talk about him. But if you're talking about the improvement of a player.
Adam Webster.
I think it's about time we started talking about Adam Webster, because
okay, let's give him some love.
He had a seriously shaky start, and as Paul said about the step up, and this is actually a kind of a portent for us that we've seen this. We saw Lewis Dunk's first season in the Premier League. It was okay. Adam Webster's first season. When we've got Ben White returning and all the noise that Leeds United fans are making, we've got Ben White has not played a Premier League game. He's got to make that step up next year, assuming that he's A, staying with us, and B, we are still in the Premier League. So Webster has taken a good three quarters of a season to get really into the groove that he needs to be. And I'm much more confident about him playing now than I was at the beginning of the season.
I mean, he was immense last night, Paul. There's still a mistake in there, as we've seen
in the last couple
of games as well. But the second goal was him being not protecting the ball as much as he possibly could do. And again, against Man City, there's some hesitation. I think he was going up for a ball with Jesus, and basically it was a 50-50 one, and he hesitated, and Jesus got in there quickly. And they scored a goal, but he has got better. I mean, in the empty stadiums, I mean, this is something which I've certainly picked up on, Paul. You get to hear the players and what they're doing, and for me, Webster is possibly the most vocal Brighton player out there.
Yeah, I mean, after changing the style of play, which is obviously Graham Potter's biggest innovation, arguably the biggest thing he's done is break up the Duffy. Dunk partnership. I nearly said Duffy Punk partnership.
That's a good one. Good beer, that.
Yeah, it works, doesn't it? Duffy Dunk partnership was just an absolute central feature of Brighton surviving in the Premier League, and to break it up was a big thing. He broke it up with a player who cost a lot of money, wasn't it? £20 million potentially. 20 million. And At times he's looked, you know, a seriously good player. At other times he's looked very easy to beat and very easy to get behind, and an error-prone centre-back. You'd expect that of a guy playing his first season in the Premier League. I think he's got the ability to make it. I just think he needs is for his concentration level to be slightly higher and for him to anticipate threats a bit better.
Okay. One another player that's come under fire in recent weeks has been the goalkeeper, Matty Ryan. Certainly did not cover himself in any glory whatsoever against Man City. But
I think it's harsh to say he's come under fire. I mean, like I say, pretty much everyone had a stinker against Man City. And it's interesting listening to Potter after the Southampton game saying that Ryan was chastising himself so much with his own performance against Man City. And this is a fellow who, you know, probably like a lot of goalkeepers who we know are all mad as snakes anyway, you know, really wants to make up for what he was doing. We know about the great saves he made last night, absolutely. But we also know about there's a couple of dropsies as well. So I think it's harsh because we've noticed Ryan's mistakes because they're so relatively rare.
Well, there was one he made against Man City. I'm pretty much sure I saw an elephant riding a bicycle at the same time. It was Keystone Cops time down there. But I mean, that save he made last night was spectacular. A lot of pundits are saying it was the save of the season, and it was wonderful. But, I mean, we've put it out there. We've asked people for what their favourite Albion save were, because I mean, let's face it. I mean, people remember the goals. Goals live long in the memories, but the saves do tend to get very much forgotten, and you know they're often like a match-winning saves as well. I mean, you think about David Stockdale's double penalty save against Sheffield Wednesday.
Well, that's quite a popular one, isn't it?
That's a very popular one, and you've got Ben Roberts' save in the playoff semi-final at Swindon. You've got Ormerod in the last minute against Hereford.
There's not just save; he did belt it straight at him.
Yeah, true, but you know, we had to stop it.
Yeah, I'm going to go for any save at Hereford in 1997. Although I don't actually remember Hereford having a shot on target, but I'm sure they did.
No, they must have. No, they're all over us. We were terrible. I do recall.
That's true.
Yeah. Kuipers. There was a great against save Bristol he City. Made against. Well, no, it was a great save he made against Blackpool, which was pretty much point blank. Belted just to about a yard to his left and he stuck his... But yes, against Bristol City, where he made about three or four great saves.
And Wolves, there was double save against Wolves in the game where chipped the keeper. Everyone remembers the goal.
I think that the Stockdale one against Sheffield Wednesday, they were great, but it's also they were with the added thing of there was tension there as well. I mean, I don't know why there is. Maybe it's bands between the fans. I don't know what it's all about, but there was one of these things that it's about time we got one over on Sheffield Wednesday. So you could actually argue that Glenn Murray's save, you know, to come up that penalty was a very good save.
I'm still maintaining that wasn't a penalty. I mean, it was his face.
Well, then use your face. What you're saying is it was a penalty. It shouldn't have been a red card. That's what you've always said.
Maybe. Yeah. But I mean, another one that's come up here is Harry Digweed's penalty save in the in that last game of the season against Ipswich when Dean Wilkins got in the last minute.
So what we're talking about here, AD, is not necessarily the quality of the save; it's the importance of the save. That's what we're talking about here, really.
But I've got to bring up the one that Dave Horsted to come up with here, which was the biggest save for the Albion ever was Mark Beeney going to Leeds.
Yes. Yeah. I mean, I'd love to question. Maybe you have you ever questioned Howard Wilkerson about it? Because I mean, surely that they could have picked up Mark Beeney for a song, and I think they actually picked up Mark Beeney for about the size of the tax bill, wasn't it?
Yeah, that's right. God, Mark Beeney. Yeah, now we're going back a bit. I want to know about Ben White. I want to know, talking of Leeds and players going to Leeds, I'd like to know what the plan is for him. I confess that I don't know what it is. So when Leeds get promoted, as they surely will, what happens? You know, does he come back and how close?
The Albion have made several noises about the fact that he's in the club's plans for next year.
He signed a new contract prior to going on loan.
Well, they can't let him play for Leeds in the Premier League. There's absolutely no point in that, is there? Particularly as Leeds might be one of the the clubs that will they'll be up against
this season, this is the thing, and this was going to be my next point. Basically, obviously, we're coming to the end of this now. They've announced the dates for the transfer window now, which is going to run from the 27th of July to the 5th of October, with an additional 10 days to sign players from the EFL. So basically, if Brighton fail to sign Lionel Messi, they can get someone from Carlisle.
Yeah. Well, it's unhappy.
It's too far.
Or quite. So.
But I mean, the wind. How do you think this window is going to play out? Because obviously, no one's got any money now.
No.
What they say.
Well.
Go on, Paul.
Is it going to affect it? I mean, are people?
Well, no one's got any money except the gazillions they've been promised by the TV companies for the next 5 years. So and Chelsea have certainly found money. Chelsea have spent ever so well in the last 6 months. They're really back in the groove. So it is possible still to spend well. I think we're going to get exciting signings. You know, clubs will continue to spend, but I'd be very interested to see what Brighton do, because last season they really pushed the envelope, didn't they? And the club went back into the red because the transfer outlay was bigger and more ambitious. So do they consolidate and say, well, all these players we bought will be better next season? Or do we have gaps in the team that we still need to fill? And if so, how much are we willing to spend?
Well, I can see the refresh button certainly being pressed. I can see
in which positions, Adi? What are the positions?
Well, next year, well, basically, with Ben White coming back, we've also got Matt Clark coming back from Derby. Whether he goes back out on loan or is sold, I don't know. But centre defence, we're going to be overloaded with potential first choice. But so, will Duffy want to be pushed down the pecking order? Will he want to be at his age? Will he be playing?
Not that old. He's younger than Lewis Dunk.
Is he?
Yeah.
Exactly. Blimey. Yeah, he doesn't look it.
No, he's about 6 weeks younger than Lewis Dunk.
But you've also got players like Dale Stevens, who has been pivotal and very important to us over a number of seasons. Is he going to be a bit part player next year? We want to see.
Well, he fell out of the reckoning a bit, didn't he? Dan Burn's done well, of course. You know, if you had Dan Burn on one side and Tariq Lamptey on the other, you wouldn't have too many problems there. Bissouma will be better again. The big issue is going to be surely the centre forward position, because Glenn Murray will play a bit next season. Do they trust Mopé to be a 15 goal a striker centre forward? Because if they don't, and if he can't contribute that many, then they're going to have to get some goals from somewhere. That does need thinking about.
Do you also think that we might send Aaron Connolly out on loan? Because he's, apart from that's
possibly, spell, yeah.
He's impressive, but he needs to be first choice for a little while.
He's a bit raw. He's very useful. He's quick. He runs, gets down a channel, and he's a menace. And he's a handy player. But I don't see him yet as a Premier League regular goal scorer.
Okay. Well, that's actually all we've got time for. Amazingly, that flew. So thank you, of course, to Paul Hay. We will come back to you and talk to you about your book when it comes out, I'm sure.
Okay.
Just briefly, what the book's going to be about?
Yeah. So it's a 150-year biography of the England men's football team stretching from 1872 to the 2022 World Cup in Qatar. And it's a wonderful, fascinating, amazing story. And the more I research it, the more interesting it becomes.
Okay, well, we want to hear all about that nearer the time. But this has been the Albion Roar. Thank you to Alan West. Thank you to Paul Hayward. I've been Adi Packham, and we'll see you again next week. Thanks for listening. See you then. Bye.